Okay. The Rosicrucian cosmal conception tells us that cosmos is born out of chaos. And it further tells us that chaos is a divine and holy state, and that what we call cosmos is probably just a small subset within chaos. And within recent decades, a new science has developed. It is called chaos science. And it's primarily mathematical and mechanical, but it has some brilliant ideas, even though it doesn't understand the spiritual side of chaos. One of the findings of chaos science is that when what is called a strange attractor, which is usually a nonlinear equation, is projected and sustained in chaos, some form of cosmos is precipitated. Meaning to say that if you hold something into existence or just hold a vector of consciousness, so to speak, in chaos, cosmos in some form or another results. Now, that's even in a very simple way, I know that this is true, because every morning when I do my shower, soap suds form at the base of the shower, and they're floating around and they're in a turbulent state, which is a state of chaos. But my feet act as strange attractors. And they really are strange attractors, because even though everything is inclined to go toward the drain, some of the soap suds will run upstream toward my feet as strange attractors. They defy gravity in that way. And it gets proved to me every day that that's the case. Now, this talk, though it is going to seem chaotic, is not about chaos. Because for me, the whole series of talks, I should say, both the morning series and this evening series, are about healing. And it's a subject that is immense. And because I'm so new to it, even though I've studied for quite a few years, it is like a chaos to me. So what I'm hoping is that I will be able to put forth a few thoughts and sustain them long enough for them to be strange attractors, so that other things of understanding will come to each of you, and that the whole subject will become more clear and more cosmic as a result. As Rosicrucian students, we are all Christian mystics. This means that we take Christ Jesus as our leader, as our Savior. At least the Christ part is the Savior, the Jesus part more as the leader. And we follow the commandments of Christ. And that means that we all aspire to be healers. And so this set of talks, or these two sets of talks, are for that purpose, to work our way toward healing. Now, it should be obvious from what I've already said that I don't intend to state anything authoritative or anything definitive. Just to make a point here or there, and from that collect and branch out into something else. Even though some of these thoughts are going to be stressed to make a point, it does not mean that they are final. lots of things in chaos are indefinite and you're sort of floaty all the time. So let's just consider that we're all thinking together and that we're all dealing with the immensely large subject of healing. And the only difference is that I'm in a place to talk where it could be just as well any of you. Now, being a Virgo, I have to be in my normal Virgo ways. I have Virgo rising. And that means some things I have to clear up about semantics. Some people think that an illness or a disease isn't over until it is healed. Others think that final state is not over until they are cured. So we have both the word healing and curing as representing something final. And I've read various authors that have put forth persuasive arguments for why healing is a better word for the final state, or curing or being cured is a better word for the final state. I don't have any preference about them. As long as the idea is right, as long as the condition is right, the word doesn't make any difference. However, I think that the word healing is more associated with spiritual therapy rather than physical therapy. For example, we hear the word grape cure, which is perfectly physical, but we don't hear the word grape healing, which would be something more spiritual. On the other hand, we never hear of the words of Christ as he did a spiritual curing. So it appears then that there is a difference between those two words. Now, this isn't just petty semantics, because what we are getting at is something much more important and something that's going to come up in these talks again and again. And that is the two poles of healing. One being the material pole, wherein conditions and symptoms are finalized, and one being the spiritual pole, wherefrom things are initialized, where they begin. The thing about all of this that we must remember at first is that healing and illness are more than just a physical condition. They are a spiritual and physical condition. That's very important, because otherwise we might treat only symptoms, physical symptoms, or we might treat only psychological causes and not make the person whole. Because we are, in the same way that the universe is on the spirit matter pole, we as human beings are on the spirit matter pole. Now, when we start looking at this, we see that some people might have objections. Some people might say, for example, that the spirit is spirit, and as spirit, it can't get ill. And that again brings probably another petty distinction in words. We could then say that the pole is psychic versus physical rather than spiritual versus physical, because there is soul growth. Psyche is the word for soul that comes from from illness. Now let's look at what the Rosicrucian philosophy says about the spirit-matter pole and try to get some understanding about healing and about health. Because we don't only want to talk about illness or disease, we want to talk about health, which is what we're aiming for. The Rosicrucian philosophy says that all illness begins in the mind. Not only psychosomatic conditions, but all illness. It's very much as the Bible says, as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. So that's what we're talking about. Our thoughts are where our initial creative activity has its origin. I'm a little lost in my notes here. So bad thinking or misthinking lead to wrong emotion or mismotivation. Eventually, mismotivation stimulates actions, bad actions or wrong actions or something like that. And the bad or wrong actions eventually precipitate physical conditions that we call disease or illness or things, afflictions, various different names. So our bodies are ultimately the expression of what we think. Thoughts become condensed. There is a train of conscious expression. And that train of conscious expression may stretch across various different types of time frames. For example, we may be fidgeting and thinking nervously and destroying brain cells immediately. And so this is a day-to-day manifestation of misthought. On the other hand, when it isn't just reactive material thinking, if we're doing creative thinking, we are tremendously slow in our creative thinking. So we might be influenced in one rebirth to a given line of thinking. And that given line of thinking may be wrong. Because sometimes when we think to ourselves, we can think whatever we want. We think we can get away with it. But eventually, if we think enough about something, it becomes manifest as a desire. Say in the next rebirth, the person has a desire that is born out of those thoughts that have collected together and have built up enough energy to project forth into the world of desire. And when that desire is there, it doesn't necessarily have to be acted on right away. Very often when a person is mental and emotional in their nature, they are introversive. And as they are introversive, they don't always act on the desires. But ultimately, desire does precipitate action. So let's say then, in a third rebirth, the person is born prone to acting in a given way and they can't help themselves. Maybe the person is a fist fighter or something like that, and they can't help themselves because the desire is there and it's pent up and it's charged, and they start acting in a wrong way. But ultimately, the thought become desire or motivation become action precipitates a change in the dense physical body, in this chemical region of the physical world. And so it becomes manifest. And if it is incorrect, and if it is not in harmony with the cosmos and the principles that interpenetrate and underlie the cosmos, we have a condition that is called illness. Our bodies are deviate from the range of the archetypal idea of what a healthy body is, and that deviation has come as a consequence of thinking, emoting, and acting. And so we have a person who is ill. And this is the way things develop. Now, it doesn't always develop in a nice, neat way in that same thing, you know, one life this, one life the next. In general, as we improve with our thinking and we have more spiritual will as a consequence of processed experience from past lives, we are able to manifest thoughts more quickly. And so we can get a quicker feedback in our creative thinking in illnesses. Now, our lives aren't that pure. Some people are like that, that they have only one line of thought that becomes a desire, that becomes a set of actions, and so on. But usually, we are like the evolution. We have things phased off, so that in one part of our character, one principle that we have misapplied may be in the state where it's causing a physical illness, and another one might just be incubating in the realm of thought. So we can see that we have these kinds of creations at various stages of development all taking place simultaneously. Now, this is because we're talking about illness, we're talking about negatives. It doesn't have to be. Because virtues and positive creations, pro-evolutionary developments, follow the same path. The thought becomes a desire, the desire to help someone or to make something better, it follows the same path. But we're trying to get an illness, which is why we take it that way. This obviously means that even illness is positive. Illness is not a bad thing. It is a very good thing. If we were allowed to have thoughts and accumulate many, many bad thoughts and have nothing come of them, we could be living in a beehive of negativity and never get out of it. But when we do precipitate something out of thoughts, desires, actions, and precipitations as impacts in the material world, we learn. There is no way that you can be ill or that you can have a broken bone or something like that and say that, no, my thinking is all right. My plan was all right. I wasn't haphazard when I fell and broke this bone. So this is, it's a very, very positive thing, but it doesn't leave any room for trying to talk our way out of reality. Now, the spirit is not bad because it makes mistakes. It is not even bad when it gets into a habit of creating thoughts and desires that are not good. Sometimes the spirit, we're waking up, and the waking up is a tremendously slow process. Even for us, where we spend hours per day trying to awaken our consciousness and do all sorts of activities that are pro-evolutionary, we make progress. Very slowly we make progress, and we're thankful for every bit of progress that we get, but it is slow. Looking back at about 43 years of trying, I can see there's progress. It isn't what I thought it would be, but I'm really glad that there was something to show for it for all of the wrong things that I did. It isn't wrong to be innocent and to be misled. That's actually what the fall of humanity is called. We were innocent, and we were misled by half-truths and misrepresentation of truths. We weren't outright lied to. We just weren't told the whole story. And we took off with it. So, it is possible to consider all of illness as an evolutionary mistake. An evolutionary mistake that we carry out to a bitter end. And from this, we learn how creative functioning takes place and what the consequences are if we misunderstand a principle or if we misapply a principle. So in this, all of this, we can see that the chemical region of the physical world and the dense physical body are a proving ground. As Harry Truman used to say, the buck stops here. We can't, there's no getting around it. When we have pain and when we're suffering, we can't say to ourselves that we're still right. We can't get away with that. You know, we wake up from our illusions and our misideas. Now, some of the most educated people in the world, our doctors, would laugh at this notion of illness, and they would call it a primitive superstition. But if we go to hospitals especially, we find a lot of people saying, "Why me? Why me?" Almost as if thinking that illness was a random thing, and that by hereditary conditions, they came, hereditary factors, they came down with some kind of a physical condition, or they just happened to be in the wrong place to get the wrong kind of virus or something like that. Deep within, the spirit knows. And the more we can apply ourselves to directing the consciousness of the individual to the spirit deep within, the quicker the pain and suffering can be fruitful. Now, we have to correct, because otherwise we'll become something like spiritual sadomasochists, and we will be the lovers of pain and suffering. Pain and suffering are a good thing, and we can see that they produce positive results in us, but they're not the only thing. We want to correct and say everything that is happening has a goal and has a purpose. And that goal and purpose are found in the principle which has been applied as a misthought. The world around us is de facto good. But that doesn't mean it couldn't be better. So we can help ourselves and others realize in a simple way that they can't get away with anything. As long as we do it in a right way, you know, if we shake a finger at them and say, "You can't get away with that," their pride is going to rise up and they're not going to listen. But the truth has to come out. Causes have to have consequences, and actions have to have reactions. Not because it's merely a law, but because they're two sides of the same coin. They're two faces of the same reality. So, if we once realize that we are the origin of causes and consequences, if we are the origin of actions and reactions, it is possible for us to manifest positive creative causes. Positive actions, whether they be thoughts or emotions. And that is an important part of healing. Remember, we're still working around that fundamental point. As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. We're trying to get at thinking and illness. Spiritually speaking, we're in an ongoing continuum. It is, even though this is the end of the line in the physical world, it isn't the end of the line for the whole process. Things cycle into the material world and they cycle back out of it. And so, it's an ongoing activity. There are always new causes. And since we're part of the causal agency, since we're part of the creation, we can institute, we can enact new causes, and we can even redirect other causes before they become final consequences. And this is a very important thing. Obviously, the further back that we get in the causal train, the easier it is to transmute and to change things so that we don't have something bad come out of our actions. Grace is a form of intuition. It is a manifestation of truth, the truth that principles are based on. And each one of us has access to that. We can bring grace into situations, and situations can be changed. If it weren't so, our aspirations to being healers, both of the spiritual end and the material end, would be futile. If it were only cause and consequence, and we couldn't put anything new and creative in, it wouldn't be worth anything. If we get the process right at the beginning, then we're more likely to completely sidestep unnecessary suffering. And that is what this is all about. We want to, suffering we can say is all right, but if it's unnecessary and if it wastes a lot of time and it keeps us from doing things that are more beautiful, it's not a very practical thing. So what we want to do is we want to be able to make corrections through healing. Now, ultimately, if we get at the beginning of this, let's take an example of the creative train and where how you get onto it. Suppose someone is pregnant. This is a creative manifestation that is just about to come to fruit. Now, before the infant is born, you can stop it by an abortion. But you're stopping something that's working very hard to become completed. And that's not the place to stop it. If you go further back on the creative train, you can use birth control. Because if you use birth control, you won't set into motion the physical process. However, if you're selfishly just trying to gratify your own desires and your own sensations, using birth control is not really getting at the root of the problem. You want to get at things before the desire is manifest. Therefore, if you get at things at the level of thought and you catch your thoughts, the thoughts that are prone to be selfish toward sensual manifestation, you stand the best chance of avoiding pain and suffering for yourself and other beings that would be coming to rebirth. So the further back on the creative chain, the closer you are to the realms of spirit, and you can draw on the grace of life spirit, you can draw on that pure truth, and you can not fall into the traps that we fall into with our selfishness. Moreover, things are easier to change then. It's easier to change our thoughts than it is to change our physical body. The biblical Christ Jesus makes a big point of that. He says, who of you by taking thought can change your body one cubit? You can't do it. It's kind of hard to change it when it's done on the physical level. So what you want to do is you want to get to things at the beginning. What this means, if we could get control of our thoughts and produce only good thoughts, that after a while we would have no suffering. However, because it takes so long for so many thoughts to become manifest, and because the spirit is so weak relative to the monstrosity that we have made of our personality, we might have to think just good thoughts for a long time. You know, what does the old statement go? If you let a river run, it runs itself clean. And any kind of stirred up mud or anything like that in the river will eventually run clean. But it's going to take a while, so if you want to start thinking good thoughts and do it that way, it's going to take a little bit. It's not easy to always have good thoughts because there are things that we don't know about. One of the things about the fall is that we've gotten ourselves into a trajectory where there are things that were unplanned for in our evolutionary creation, and therefore there are things that are unknown. And in the process of falling, as we have fallen, by focusing so much on matter, we have blinded ourselves, and the consequence of that blindness is ignorance. We're ignorant of a lot of things. A lot of people don't even really know how much they sin. I don't like to use that word that strongly, but they don't know how much they sin. They think that's just me. That's just the way I am. It's a great testament. If you read Max Heindel, he has that famous letter that he wrote to Charles Ledbetter, where he said that when he came to the first talk by Ledbetter, he was a scoundrel, and he wanted to learn about clairvoyance so that he could take advantage of people by knowing their secrets. And he said that, I was a man of the flesh, and I smoked and I drank and I did things like that. And then he came to the next lecture, and he thought it was going to be more on clairvoyance, and it was on cause and consequence. And then he said to himself, I never even knew that I had the ability to control my thoughts. He thought, like most people do, that thoughts just happen, that one doesn't deliberately think. And then he writes further on that within a few weeks' time, he had pretty much general control over all of his thoughts, and he never thought negative thoughts. Now, this is somebody that's really ripe. This is somebody that, you know, my hat is off to somebody that can do that. All right, it's time to take a little bit of a different direction, and let's go back to my feet. It's fascinating the way strange attractors work. Once a strange attractor is inserted and sustained, things are attracted, many of which were unexpected. And that includes thinking. On the subject of right thinking, correct thinking, Plato Socrates, you don't know which one it originated from, had an interesting idea about this difficult question. It goes something like this. Socrates propounds the question, is it possible to have wrong thoughts? He couldn't fathom how somebody could have wrong thoughts. This is true if it is deliberative thinking with the spirit doing the thinking, because the thinker then is divine. And the thoughts are precipitated out of universal spiritual ideas, which are themselves transcendent and divine. Furthermore, if done right, thoughts should contain intuitions, which are bits of truth straight from life spirit, which is pure truth. Obviously, we do misthink. Sometimes it's from lack of experience, if nothing else. Thinking at our stage of development or better, our stage of undevelopment, is a skill. It's something that we learn how to do. I learned how to drive a car. And for me, the first time I got behind the wheel and drove a car, I thought I was driving the Empire State Building. It was that big, and how are you supposed to control that right down to a half inch or something like that? But after a while, your consciousness and your skill extends itself to the car, and you can do all sorts of maneuvers that you never would have thought of in the first place. And so, the more we practice correct thinking, even correct observation of the external world around us, the more likely our thoughts are going to be true. The more likely we are to be healers or to be healed. It's an important thing for a patient to learn correct thinking. Not even necessarily only moral thinking about the way they have been thinking wrong things and how it resulted as their condition. That's important thinking, but it doesn't only have to be that. Just learning to think correctly and truly is an important thing. But back on this question of Plato, how is it possible to have wrong thoughts? Well, it turns out that our concrete mind, which is our vehicle for doing the thinking, isn't always only in the hands of our true self nature. Sometimes it's in the hands of that pseudo-self, which has taken the characteristics of a self, and in that it has aligned itself with the mind in such a way that it can revel in its desires and satisfy its desires, especially driving the body till it's all burned up for its own ends. It has some access to the mind. So this pseudo-self was originally given to us as a protector. After the fall, the gods could not lead us around willy-nilly. And so we had to have something to protect us until the spirit could become completely indwelling, which even at this point is very, very little. The only case we have of it in the Bible is the case of Jesus at the Mount of Transfiguration, the Spirit drawing completely into the body and emanating out of the physical body. So this we're involved in a long process here. And since the gods couldn't rule us like robots, we were given this pseudo-self. And the function of this pseudo-self was to look out for number one until the real number one could come in and take over. But under the influence of the Lucifers and other demoniacal beings, it became polluted in the same way that we became polluted in the fall as we fell. And the Lucifers helped us to realize that in our lower nature, we could take over the whole psychic apparatus and work in the unconscious part of our being. And we could, therefore, the Lucifers could have us acting in the way that they could gain experience from us through the desire manifestations that we put so much into. So this tells us something about wrong thoughts. Wrong thoughts come from an amoral, immoral, lower nature that cares only about the fulfillment of its own satisfaction, its own desire satisfaction. But what about misthoughts? We can see how bad thoughts can produce illnesses, but what about misthoughts? Even if we deliberatively think about things, we can have mistaken thoughts. They're not bad, But for example, suppose we're thinking on an experience that is a consequence of an optical illusion, or a belief that society holds that things are one way or another, and we start thinking on that, and since the basis on which we are thinking is untrue, we produce misthoughts. Now the fact is that we are participating in an evolutionary creation. And in this evolutionary creation, there are new things, and there are unknown things. And it is these new things and unknown things that we waken our consciousness by. And by the same stroke, we realize them, because we're part of the creative activity. If we knew everything before the evolutionary creation began, we wouldn't need to go through it all. We wouldn't need to go through all of these millions and millions of changes. There's so much to our spiritual nature, and there are so many facets to what we can possibly be, and that we can make, that we can realize and carry out the glory of the divine creation, that it is almost beyond our conception. And we have so many evolutionary conditions, and each of them brings something out of us. Just look at the plants that we have around us. Each plant is a manifestation of a totally different concept, and it has a character that's all of its own. And there are hundreds of millions of species, and of all the hundreds of millions of species that there are, they constitute less than 2% of all the species that have ever been. And all of them are making manifest the glory of the divine. And so there's a lot of things that we go through. We go through all kinds of experiences. And there are unknown things, and there are new things. Now, because we have some understanding of the whole process, because we all have read part two of the Cosmal Conception, and we can see what a grand conception this is, and that's only a very, very skeletal expression or exhibition of that creative expression, we have some idea of what's coming. And we anticipate. But the way it works is, even if we anticipate, and even if somebody tells us what's going to happen next, it is never as good as experiencing the reality. Because there's something in the experiencing of the reality that really makes it real. I don't know, that's three reels in one sentence, and a short one at that. So, we are beginning thinkers. And we are beginning thinkers who are trying to get beyond being perverted thinkers. And we are thinkers that must think about new things. And when they are new, we don't know about them. And we are not so far advanced that we have intuition all the time. So it is likely that we're going to make mistakes. We can study, and we can try new things. But we have to be able to actually do them and make mistakes in the process. But it isn't only reality that changes, it's we that change. And in evolutionary process, the adaptation and the ability to change is extremely important. If we don't change, we fall out of the stream, or we lag in the stream of development, and it's sort of like we're out of pitch. We're out of tune with the whole creation that's going on. So, when we make mistakes, we live through the consequences just as if we had bad thoughts. And thus we can say that there are what could be called evolutionary illnesses. So not all illnesses are a consequence of bad thought. Some of them are a consequence of misthoughts. Now let's give an example. We know that year by year there is more ultraviolet light coming into our atmosphere. And it's something that goes beyond the hole in the ozone layer. The hole in the ozone layer is only describing the final superficial experience of it. If we look at the reports from valuable clairvoyants that we can trust, and we read their reports about the ethers, and if we lay them alongside the reports of the physicists, such like Feynman's physics, lectures on physics is a good source for this, we see that what is called ultraviolet light has identical characteristics to what is called etheric light by the clairvoyants. For one thing, neither can penetrate glass. For another, most insects are active in what is called the ultraviolet range, or that means, which means they have etheric vision. And so there are many, many more if you want to seek them out. Now, this incoming of ultraviolet light, if the ultraviolet light is the another name for the ethers, this is the New Jerusalem that is coming down from heaven, which means that this globe, and this is in cosmological speak, Rosicrucian cosmological speak, we are in the fourth revolution of globe D of the Earth period. And soon in cosmic times, maybe many millions of years, maybe thousands, the physical Earth is going to dissolve, and in its place there is forming an etheric globe, which is going to be our new sphere of activity. This is one of those larger cycles, and this is one of these things that can't necessarily be predicted, and this is one of these things that comes up from within. And so, we have right now to deal with ozone. Melanoma, you live in Australia, I have a friend that grew up on a sheep station, and it was nothing that they'd go in several times a year and have a melanoma cut off their skin because the ultraviolet was so strong that melanoma just kept cropping up all the time. Now, the way we adapt to this, this seems like something like we can't think of the influx of the New Jerusalem as something evil. It's something that we all hope for, that we'll be free from this physical body. But our adaption to it is something that requires an evolutionary activity on our part. And what it is we're taught in the Rosicrucian philosophy that the next step is establishing the vital body, which is made out of those same ethers, and that the richer that our vital body is, especially in the two so-called higher ethers, the better our consciousness is, and the better that we can understand the etheric atmosphere. Thus, if we take steps to build and strengthen our vital body, it acts as a buffer, so that the incoming etheric light of the New Jerusalem, or the hole in the ozone layer, whatever you want to call it, is neutralized by this buffer. So what looks like a horrible thing, it may even have been a horrible thing with the fluorocarbons and the, you know, we want to blow hairspray on ourselves and things like that. That seemed like a horrible thing that was raised by vanity and laziness. The wise shall be captured in their folly. And this is something that helps us, even though it's a hard thing for us, and this is an example of an evolutionary kind of illness, melanoma as an evolutionary illness. So, we have evolutionary illnesses on various different scales. Every one of us has experienced an evolutionary illness or dis-ease or discomfort at some time in our life. Suppose we want to do something new, something we have never done before, and something that's wonderful. Suppose it's something like playing a guitar or doing gymnastic or something like that. In order to do, to perform what we would like to perform, we have to build the muscles. But what happens when we build the muscles? We have pain. So pain, for the most part, in evolution is an indicator of something that we've done wrong. Pain is a consequence of pleasure. You know, that we seek too much pleasure, and the consequence of it is so that we don't harden completely from the satiation of desire, pain comes along to soften us up. That's what happens when people moan in bed in pain and suffer. I've done it. The pain softens us up. It humbles us as we are just ready to run off on the next desire, and we are not likely to think of ourselves as such potent, powerful beings. It gives us a little bit of humility, and we become softer human beings. But pain, sometimes, that discomfort, that dis-ease, is a consequence of an evolutionary illness, which is obviously a good thing. If we're learning to dance and be able to express ourselves in movements like never before, the pain is a good thing. All right. Now it's time to shift gears again and get back to another... You see what we're doing here. This is not a highly organized talk. It's sort of like we're walking along and we're looking at this tree or we're looking at that plant or something like that, and it's a slow, gradual, you know, we're picking up flowers along the way as we go. All right. Let's look at a related matter with regard to healing and then try to get back to our main line of thought, the path that we were been taking all night. And this thought is an important thought. Now, for the last few minutes, we've been talking about the evolutionary creation, and we've been talking about it in the human microcosm in terms of evolutionary illness. Now, let's look at one characteristic of the way we experience that evolutionary creation right now, whether it's in microcosm in our life or whether it's all humanity in the great cosmic scheme of things. Let's look at time. Let's look at a characteristic of time that, with regard to action and reaction, cause and consequence. For the most part, especially if we look back at our lives, we tend to think of time flowing in a forward direction, that the future is a consequence of the past. In fact, for most people, this is so habitual and it's so much accepted as a social prejudice in thought that people think that this is all there is, that there is only a going forward. But that is not the whole story. If we look into spiritual philosophy, and if we turn inward and we start having spiritual experiences, we realize that there is a flow of time that comes from the future to the present. And it isn't just the result of resistance from our forward motion of time moving into the future. There are two streams of time. In fact, in ancient times, in Greek mythology, the time that flows from the future to the past was called Promethean time. It was something that there was another name for it. That's too far aside, I won't go in. So, the flow from the future contains things that are in the archetype. that are in the divine creative thought. It also contains things that we have taken back to the Spirit, which is the creative source, and that are now coming out in the future stream. Sometimes our past deeds, when they come back to us, it's not like looking back and say, oh, that's a result of that. We sometimes, our causes have been digested so thoroughly that their consequences can no longer be followed in a linear logical train, and they come out to us as new things that fit right into the archetype of the evolutionary creation. So, we have things that come to us from the future and things that we build from the past. I'm going to have to cut some material here because it's getting way too long. It's over an hour. Sorry about that. These are meant to be an hour long. Now, both of these streams flow into the present. And we recognize them as the present when they're in the present, but we don't recognize that they are significantly different. And because of that, we don't realize that there are attitudes or stances that we have to have for each of these flows of time. With regard to the flow from the future, it seems best to be subjective. Not all things of the future are determined. The details aren't determined. That doesn't happen until they are brought into the present. Until something flows from the future into the present, it doesn't necessarily have to be. It can be changed. This is why we think in terms of healing, because we know we can change these things and we work at changing them. Of course, since many of the things that are coming from the future are coming from divine archetypes created by the spiritual hierarchies, they're pretty hard to change, and it's probably best to be subjective toward them, anticipate them, accept them, and work with them. If we do try to change them, we find that it's very much like beating our head against the wall, because the reality is the reality of them. But the way things become manifest in this world can be changed. And that is part of what our work is here. We are specialists in this isolated material world, and we are specialists who are intended to change things and bring them into finality. That's what our deviation from the plan has meant. We are in blind, solitary confinement here in the dense physical world, and the cosmos takes advantage of that. And it takes advantage of that by allowing us to express our creativity by making the details of things flowing from the future into the present creatively as we would have them be. So, we want to be subjective. We don't want to say, apply our attitudes from the past to the future and say that the future is going to be like the past, because then we don't see the future as it really is. This is the kind of subjectivity we need to have. With regard to the past, the attitude and stance that we need to have is objectivity. All one has to do is go to one's class reunion to understand that we have to be very objective about the past. The past is done, it's over, it's factual. It is what it is. If we become subjective about the past, we become nostalgic. It's like going to the class reunion and talking about those same old things we did back in high school, and all the rest of your life where you've learned and had all kinds of good experiences can't get anywhere because they have all this nostalgia for the past. So, the present sometimes seems grim to us because the world fights back. That's what makes the world alive, If the world did everything we want it to do all very easy, it wouldn't be a live world. It's a reality that we must face, and there is freedom and there is life in the fact that the world fights back. So, if we become subjective about the past, we're living in illusions, we're living in fantasy. And there are a lot of people that do this. And not just in personal memories, there are a lot of people who feel disenfranchised. There are millions of them in the United States. All they have to do is turn on the radio late at night and listen to Coast Live. There are a lot of people who would like to, they hear about equations from physics which can be reversed, and they think about going back into the past and changing the past so that the present could be better. And these same people are so disenfranchised and have such an attitude that they don't put energy into changing the present so that the future could be better. And they have this nostalgia for time travel. They want to go back into the past and change the present. And it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way because reality, when something has been finalized in this material world, the experience of the reality has stamped that this is what it is. And when you go into the future, you are a different person that goes into the future than you were in the past. And so we can see that there are two attitudes. The attitude of subjectivity or acceptance or receptivity toward the future and eager anticipation. And from the past, we can see what worked in the past, and we can see a logical development, and we can be very objective. What's the famous statement about history? That those who do not study history will not learn its lessons, and they will be repeated again. So we have these. Now, the fact of the matter is that we have fallen. Let's look at this on a very macrocosmic scale. And the fact of the matter is that when we fell, we deviated from divine intent. And we have made ourselves materially blind and materialistic in our philosophical attitudes. And we have learned to be selfish in such a way that it is unharmonious to the whole, and we have interjected sin into the world, which is a great intentional misharmony. So things have changed. So with regard to the past, things have changed. We can't go back to a golden age that was intended. We can't go forward to a new golden age according to the old cosmic archetype for our evolutionary creation. We have to look creatively. There are examples of this. Suppose we are in a ship, and for some reason or another, a squall comes up and drives us off course. And we find ourselves off course, and we aren't taking the route that we intended to take in the first place. We don't just quit, and we don't try to go back to where we were and then go forward. What we do is we start with a new course. We take a reading, and we do something new. This is what creation means. We are creative beings. For our disobedience, we have produced a new set of things in that new set of conditions, we must now be creative. We force ourselves to be creative in an unprecedented way, because the divine hierarchies don't know about this world the way we know about it. You see them leading a bird, and that bird doesn't understand. I've seen birds try to knock out another bird in a hubcap all afternoon until because the group spirit of that bird doesn't understand the reflection in that manner. So we toyed with creativity. We selfishly arrogated it to ourselves. And as a result, we have produced a whole new set of conditions. And that whole new set of conditions, it's almost like we are saying to ourselves, or the cosmos is saying to us through ourselves, well, we wanted to be creative and do our own thing. Now we have to really be creative to make our way back, because we're going through an area that is uncharted. All right. This brings us back to what we're trying to get at. The goal of healing is to make a person whole. But what the concept of a whole person is different because of the sins of the person that has resulted as the illness. Therefore, if there is any healing to take place, the agent, the healer, and the patient, the one suffering, both have to work creatively. You can't create back to something before. Some people might say, well, the physical body is built out of the matrix of the vital body, and all you have to do is heal back to that matrix. That's not so, because the vital body and the physical body change throughout life. They change together. You can't go back to what things were before you made your error. So this is a really important thing. If a healing is to be successful, or even if we apply it to self-improvement, we have to be willing to be creative. We have to be willing to at least have some conception of where we can go from where we are now. The healing force, when we're talking about the actual physical healing, is the same force that is used to generate bodies. The spinal sexual energy, when turned downward and outward, working through the semen and sperm and the ova, is the same energy that gives us the word of power, that gives us the creative ability. And they both require creativity. So if somebody has to be healed, they have to be new people. And that means they have to think of themselves differently. They have to think of reality differently. There is that statement that is attributed to St. Paul, be ye renewed, and renewing is another way of saying healing, be ye renewed by the perfecting of your mind, which means thinking in a new and a better way. So, whether we're functioning as invisible helpers, or whether people are coming to us for counsel, for to be healed, it is imperative for us to get the individual, the patient, to think about themselves in a new way. If you're functioning as a healer, you can think together with the patient, and in that way you can develop a harmonious new line of creation, just like the ship that was blown off course. Now we have a few thoughts dangling, but that's far enough as for going tonight, and we'll continue here from here tomorrow and pick up some more thoughts on healing and go forward. For now, let's close with the Rosicrucian student's prayer. O God, increase our love for Thee, so that we may serve Thee better from day to day. Let the words of our mouths and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in Thy sight, O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer.